Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Now in depth on the future of gerrymandering. It's on the line as cases in both Texas and Wisconsin are before courts. Later this fall, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear the Wisconsin case in which plaintiffs contend that a Republican-drawn map discriminates against voters who are not registered Republicans. A lower court said the map was unconstitutional. In Texas, a panel of federal judges is considering this question. Did Republican leaders intentionally disenfranchise voters of color as they drew up congressional districts? Were they specifically trying to dilute the voting clout of minority Texans? So today, a conversation about these cases, what the outcomes will mean for voters nationwide, and a lot of information about just what happens in gerrymandering. And I'd like you to think about this. Should more states, including our states here in the upper Midwest, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, use independent commissions to draw voting districts? Or is it fair that majority rules, that the party that holds the power in the state legislature really gets to control redistricting? These cases often go to the courts, but in the end, the party in power often gets the first draft of these districts. So I'd like you to think about that. Other questions you have about gerrymandering and its effect on politics? Here's the number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Emily Bazelon is with us. She's a staff writer for the New York Times and a fellow at Yale Law School. She's been writing a bit about gerrymandering, and she's with us today from New Haven, Connecticut. And Emily, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Michael Lee is with us. He's senior counsel for the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, and he's with us today from New York. And Michael, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show as well.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Michael, I want to check some facts here on Texas. That case has not yet been decided, has it, since I last looked?
No, it has been appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will hear the case sometime this term, probably after the first of the year. There's a lot of briefing that needs to be done, but it has not yet been decided by the Supreme Court.
So I want to talk about our neighbor of Wisconsin first. This is the first redistricting case that the U.S. Supreme Court has heard in 10 years. How important is this case, Michael, in your view?
The Wisconsin case, it's huge. The Supreme Court has never clearly put partisan gerrymandering out of bounds in the same way that it's put racial gerrymandering out of bounds. And that's led to some anomalies, particularly in the South, where you see lawmakers claiming that, no, we weren't trying to discriminate against African Americans. We were just trying to discriminate against Democrats. And lo and behold, they just happened to be African Americans. And you see something similar playing out in Texas with Latinos. But beyond the South, I mean, this is huge. The gerrymandering of the sort of extreme type that you see in Wisconsin is growing. It's getting worse, and there's every evidence that it's going to get even worse in the next cycle, because technology and big data in particular allow us to know more and more about voters, and that means that you can draw lines ever so carefully to make sure that districts perform in the way that you do. And like you saw in Wisconsin, you can have one party grab a large share of seats and lock that share of seats in,
right.
And that's really harmful for democracy and really undermines it.
You know, I'll come back on this tech and big data question here, but Emily, Wisconsin's a really interesting state politically. As you know, the state legislature is controlled by Republicans, and Governor Walker is a Republican, and President Obama won Wisconsin twice, but President Trump took the state in 2016 by 22,000 votes. I mean, that is what we would call a truly purple state. But when you look at the way the districts are drawn, it doesn't seem to really reflect that. Give me some insight on what you see in Wisconsin.
Well, you're right about that. And what it shows is that when you have a state in which the legislature controls redistricting, and that's most states in the country, it matters tremendously who controls the legislature and the governor's mansion right after the census. So, you know, we have a census in this country every 10 years. So after the 2010 census, the Republicans were in control. of both state houses and the governor's office. And when you have that kind of sole control, you open the door to redistricting that maximizes the partisan advantage of the party that's in power. At the moment, Michael is right, the Supreme Court has never struck down a redistricting plan for partisan gerrymandering. And so we have a system that effectively allows that kind of taking of partisan advantage. And the question is whether it truly is constitutional or whether there should be some kind of limit so that one party can't entrench itself in power for the entire 10 years by drawing maps in a way that that helps its candidates and hurts the other side.
Well, so Emily, here's my question about that then. I mean, as you note, the Constitution specifically gives state lawmakers the right to draw lines. And of course, that's going to be a partisan endeavor. But are courts trying to decide how partisan is too partisan? I mean, is that kind of at the bottom of this?
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to think about it. The best metaphor I came up with comes from a couple of political scientists, and they were talking about refereeing a boxing match. So look, like boxing is about punching the other side in the same way that redistricting, if a legislature does it, is about politics. But when you have referees at a boxing match, they're still calling things out of bounds that lie at the extreme of the kind of punching you're allowed to do. And so, right? So the plaintiffs in this Wisconsin case are asking the Supreme Court to set some boundaries, some way of refereeing gerrymandering at the extremes.
So, Michael, no matter what, unless and I want to talk about this in a second, some of the states that use the independent commissions, no matter what, it is going to be a partisan approach here. It's just, when do you cross the line of disenfranchising voters who have a right to participate as fully as they can in the election process? And the courts are going to have to figure that out. Do you think we'll have clarity on the other side of the Texas case and the Wisconsin case at the Supreme Court?
Well, I think a lot of people are hopeful that there will be some clarity, and in particular when you're talking about this sort of extreme gerrymandering. And it's important to maybe step back a little bit and understand that gerrymandering isn't one thing. It's actually many things. And I often tell people it's sort of like cancer, right? There's brain cancer, and there's stomach cancer, and there's skin cancer, and they're all cancers, and they're all bad, but they have different causes and different symptoms and may have different treatments. And in the same way, you know, there's gerrymandering that sort of protects an incumbent. There's gerrymandering where you draw districts so your brother-in-law can win a seat in Congress. But then there's this sort of extreme gerrymandering that has taken place in Wisconsin and in like North Carolina and Pennsylvania. And that's where a party grabs an extra large share of seats and locks it in. And that turns out to be something that we can measure fairly reliably, not using just one test, but multiple tests, and we can sort of really get at that very precisely. That of course is not the end of the inquiry. A state still has a chance to defend maps, but it at least gives us a signal of where we need to look more closely, and that is something that can easily be administered and I think is a nice, clear rule.
I've been asking, if you've just joined the conversation here about gerrymandering, whether you as voters believe that more states should use independent commissions and whether you believe that that would bring more fairness into the drawing of electoral lines. Or is it fair that the party in power, and that's the way it works in our state and most of them, really gets the benefit of the doubt on drawing these districts, except when it exceeds, and that's kind of what we're talking about now, where how partisan is too partisan. So I'd like your views on that. Mallory says on Twitter, we should definitely use independent groups to draw the lines, but in these divided times, who's truly independent? And Christopher says, every state should use indie commissions and technology to give us districts that make sense. No more gerrymandering. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, to speak to this. And on Twitter, at Kerry NPR, and a call here from Wood in Golden Valley. Hi.
Hi. I have a question for Emily and Michael.
Sure.
And it sounds like it might be off topic, but I want to bring it back to the topic at hand. My question is, I'd like you two to consider a conservative Christian in Minneapolis who has a Democratic mayor and a Democratic city council and a Democratic congressional representative and a Democratic senator and a Democratic governor. And I want to ask you, is that is that person represented by their leadership, or how are they represented?
Emily, what would you say to that?
Well, so, you know, people are not always going to live. So let's assume that Minneapolis elects Democrats in the part of the city that this conservative Christian lives. And people don't always live in the place that elects candidates of their choice. Like, that's a fact of life in terms of what the concentration of voters is. It's also true that increasingly Americans are choosing to live among people who share their political ideologies. So this is this idea called the big sort, where we see conservatives and Republicans tending to live more than they used to in suburbs and rural areas, and Democrats and liberals flocking to cities. And there is no doubt that if you live in a place where you're in the minority in terms of your political ideology, you're not necessarily going to have a representative who you agree with. And that has to do with the geography. Gerrymandering comes into this if the redistricting map is drawn in such a way that very deliberately minimizes the influence of one group of voters to the advantage of the other group of voters. So it's not as if we imagine a world in which everybody gets to vote for a winning candidate, right? Like, that's not going to happen. But what we want is a relatively high number of competitive races. We want, I think, as a kind of health of democracy sort of argument, we want a world in which there are many maps that can be drawn, and there's very sophisticated computer technology now that allows the map makers to see all those maps. And I would argue that, you know, as a sort of general principle, we would want a map that that emphasizes competition and keeps together a city or a county as opposed to going across lines, more than we want a map that simply maximizes partisan advantage.
Let me come back to what. So what about that answer then? What, does that get to what you were getting at?
It doesn't quite, because, yes, I agree with everything Emily said, and those are great goals. But the question is, what about those who don't win, who don't vote for the winning candidate? Are they still represented by someone they didn't vote for?
Well, Michael, you are not guaranteed, right, in your district that a person who shares your political leanings or your views is going to end up being your representative, are you?
Right. You're not. We in our country, we have chosen not to have a system of proportional representation like in some countries they do. In Israel, everybody just votes, you know, for a party, and the party, the seats are allocated depending on which party gets the most votes. But we've chosen not to do that, and that's a legitimate choice that we've made, in part because having districts allows us to represent communities and cities and other sorts of interests that you don't necessarily get when you have a system of pure proportional representation. And so having made that choice, you may not get a candidate who you prefer, but that's not to say that you aren't represented in some sense, right? You still have access to the representative. The question is whether that representative is maximally responsive to you. I guess the question, though, that when we look at when we're talking about gerrymandering is at a statewide level, whether there is representativeness when you look at the state as a whole, not in any particular district. And that really gets at something that the framers of the Constitution really valued a lot. John Adams talked about how representative assemblies and how Congress should be an exact portrait, a miniature of the people as a whole, and that all voices in a state should be at the table when important decisions are being made, whether that's in the state legislature or in Congress. And what you have in when you have these sort of aggressive gerrymanders is you don't have that. So North Carolina is quintessential swing state, 50-50. Donald Trump won it, but Democrat Floyd Cooper was elected governor. Democrats won seats in the North Carolina Supreme Court this year or last year. And yet the congressional delegation is 10-3 in favor of Republicans, and it's been 10-3 since virtually the start of the decade. And North Carolina is not it's a Republican-leaning state. It's not a 10-3 state. And so you lose that representativeness because of these extreme gerrymanders, and that's really sort of what we're talking about when we're talking about Wisconsin-type gerrymandering.
Michael, I read your Brennan Center report on some of these districts that are so misshapen, it just kind of defies logic. And your report shows that North Carolina, Michigan, and Pennsylvania are the, quote, most extreme levels of partisan bias in redistricting. Well, you can't help but look at those states and say, and they are also among the most competitive states in, well, certainly in presidential elections. No coincidence? I mean, do you often find that, these two are tied together?
Yes. And in fact, you know, the interesting thing when we did the study is we found that all of the worst gerrymanders, at least at the congressional level, are in battleground states. And when you think about it, that's not surprising. It's surprising at first because you would think that that would be the last place that you would have this. But it's not surprising if you think about it, because in battleground states like Wisconsin or like North Carolina or Pennsylvania, if you look at a precinct level map of the state, you have a lot of pink, you have a lot of light blue spread across a lot of the state.
Uh-huh.
This is not, in other words, Wisconsin is not Nebraska, where, you know, outside
right.
of the cities, it's pretty dark red.
Right.
And it's that pink and light blue that enables you to slice and dice and recombine voters to give one party or the other an advantage. And that's really key. So battleground states and single party control are the two biggest things that correlate to this kind of extreme gerrymandering.
Emily, a call for you here from Bill in Minneapolis. Bill, what's your question for Emily?
Good morning.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, with the current system of making political districting such a politically driven process, what is it that we might lose if we were to just take that process away from the politicians completely and give it to the courts, or perhaps give it to professional demographers?
That's a really good
question. I'll take my question off the air.
Yeah, thanks. Emily?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are several states that have either bipartisan or nonpartisan commissions that draw the lines. And California, Arizona, states on both sides of the political divide have used this method. And it is a way of trying to take out some of the politics and kind of seeking a partisan advantage. And it creates maps overall in general that have more competition in them and less maximizing of political advantage. So if those are your goals, then these commissions look like a pretty good step to take. Courts being in control of redistricting is another possibility, but, you know, it raises questions about whether this is really the proper role of judges or at least the ideal solution. We usually think of courts overseeing the drawing of lines or creating maps themselves as a kind of last resort, because it's taking that role away from the legislature without the electorate agreeing to that outcome. So that seems like a sort of second kind of possibility, but maybe not as good in terms of democratic values as the idea of a commission that people have voted for in a state referendum or the legislature has created.
If you've just gotten in on the conversation, we're talking about gerrymandering in depth here with Emily Bazelon, staff writer for The New York Times and a fellow at the Yale Law School, and Michael Lee, a senior counsel for the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, with this case headed or going to be heard, I should say, at the U.S. Supreme Court from Wisconsin. That's happening this fall. And then these Texas judges about to make a ruling at some point on this case in Texas. We're kind of examining, yes, gerrymandering is partisan, but as noted here, when is the process so partisan that it disenfranchises voters? What are some of the things that the judges will consider here? What does it mean for voters? Got some good questions about what it means for policies here off of Twitter. And I just wonder if you think that, given what our guests have said already, is it fair that the majority really rules in this redistricting process? Or should our state and others really turn more to independent commissions to draw voting districts? 800-242-2828-651-227-6000 and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Michael, what's the evidence show about these commissions, as Emily noted, Arizona, California, 11 other states, about how the fairness of the district redrawing looks once you've got an Indy commission involved?
Well, the evidence, if you're talking about sort of the existence of this extreme gerrymandering of the sort that you see in Wisconsin and North Carolina, the evidence is that when a commission draws a map, you don't have that problem.
Yeah.
And the same thing goes for courts, or where the legislature is split, or you have a governor of the other party who can veto a redistricting bill. The reason for that is simply if everybody sort of has a voice in the process and has some kind of veto or check in the process, then you end up with maps that are by and large fair. And that's certainly been the case in California, which used to have a problem with high partisan bias in its maps. But since it's adopted a commission, has had very balanced maps, lo and behold, which, you know, again, probably sort of undercuts the idea that it's all the big sort of geography, because California used to have that problem, but now it doesn't. And there's a lot of evidence, at least with respect to this problem, that they work really well. Having said that, not all commissions are created equal. There's certainly some that are better than others. But the key thing about commissions is, like in California, you have Democrats, independents, and Republicans on the commission, and all three buckets have to approve a map. It's not just majority rules. And that gives every group a veto and encourages negotiation and consensus around maps. So there's a lot of evidence that they really work well, and it's a good model to follow.
Emily, in reading about this to prepare for the show, I read about something called cracking in redistricting. Do you know what that is?
I sure do. So there's sort of two techniques of gerrymandering. They're called cracking and packing. That's the shorthand. Uh-huh. And cracking refers to spreading out imagine that it's the Democrats who are doing the gerrymandering. So then the map makers would spread out the Republican voters to minimize their influence over elections, you know, keep everyone at a minority in as many districts as possible so that the Democrats can win more of the offices.
I mean,
right?
basically, just to make this clear, they're doing that so that these voters cannot create like a voting block, right, that would then be influential.
Yes, that's exactly right. It's a way of trying to make sure that your side wins as much as possible and the other side loses as much as possible. And then the other half of this is called packing. And that's when you kind of concentrate as many voters of the other side into as few districts as possible. So, for example, if you live in a city that is 80% Democratic, you could draw the district lines as like spokes of the wheel, where you make the urban voters part with the suburbs part of, say, 7 or 8 districts. Uh-huh. Or you can draw the lines so that you concentrate them in 5 districts. Their representatives win those districts by 80 or 90%, but then the suburbs elect someone who's usually a Republican who wouldn't be maybe getting into office if he or she had a greater share of Democrats in his or her district.
Hmm. Call here from Steve in Eagan. Hi, Steve. What do you want to know? Oh, we might have lost Steve. To Lorraine in Menominee, Wisconsin. Hi, Lorraine. Of course, you live in the state where this case is headed to the Supreme Court. What do you want to say?
I do now. I'm wondering about the lasting cultural effects of gerrymandering, because the districts change, right? And so the laws change that I'm thinking of the youth that grow up under them now under this last 10 years or so.
Uh-huh.
And I noticed that they think differently than I did as growing up as a youth in Minnesota and I might be naive, but when I was growing up in Minnesota, I always thought of Wisconsin as my sister or brother state. It was the state everybody came to go to college if you wanted to be a teacher or certain other things. And that whole system has fallen apart. And I've noticed that the youth over here are starting to think differently. So even if we change the lines back, how long does it take for the culture to respond?
Michael, that's kind of an interesting question. Because I mean, what she's really saying is, so now we're living under the policies, right, that gave one party or the other the advantage. And she's starting to see people, I don't know what, either accept or reject those policies. How long is the fallout from the kind of political rule that we've seen in Wisconsin for so long?
Well, there's no question that when you have these types of gerrymanders, you end up with less competition. And the effect of less competition is that there's not the robust marketplace of ideas that you would want. And so young people or, frankly, older people living in these areas don't hear both sides of the debate. They don't sort of hear the different ideas about how local government should go. They may hear something about the presidential race or you know, something statewide, but they don't sort of hear a debate about what you should do about roads or schools or, you know, any number of local issues. And that really is hurtful to democracy. There's absolutely no question that that occurs.
Carol asks, and Emily, this is kind of going back into the history of gerrymandering. Why do we have it? Why can't we just use the popular vote? She says, I realize we need districts, but particularly in presidential, I'd like to see the popular vote instead of the electoral vote. How are they tied together if they are?
Right. So let's sort out a couple of different things. So there's the Electoral College, which creates these problems or at least issues in presidential elections where someone can win the popular vote nationally, but lose the election. That's what just happened to Hillary Clinton. That's one set of issues. And there are all kinds of questions you can ask about the wisdom of the Electoral College and whether we should still have it. Gerrymandering and redistricting is a separate set of concerns. And as we've been discussing, the Constitution gave the legislatures the power to draw the lines that elect members of the U.S. House and the State Assembly and State Senates. Anywhere where you have to redraw map lines every 10 years in order to make sure that each district has roughly equal number of people in it, right? The idea of one person, one vote. So we're talking about two different aspects of our electoral system and parts of our Constitution, redistricting and the Electoral College. They're related, but also distinct.
Excellent. On Twitter here, Michael, Pete says, independent commissions, absolutely. The current system simply perpetuates the longstanding system of racism in our country. Michael, at the beginning, we talked about what happened in a state like North Carolina, and I think you said something like, when Republicans disenfranchised voters, it happened to be Democratic voters, it happened to be that those are a lot of voters of color. Where does race influence gerrymandering? And do you expect, depending on whatever the U.S. Supreme Court says about what Wisconsin has done, some of this to be addressed?
Well, there certainly is a lot of overlay between race and politics, especially in the South, but not limited to the South. You know, if you don't have a limit on partisan gerrymandering, the risk and the danger, especially now that the Supreme Court has limited the reach of the Voting Rights Act, is that come 2021, you're going to have people go to town on politics and just try to put everything in the politics bucket in order to do things that have a very negative racial impact on communities of color. And you know, in some ways, the court has set up this system, and in some ways, it's a false binary, right? You know, they ask us whether it was race or politics, as though it couldn't somehow be both kind of fused way, right?
Right.
But you know, nonetheless, that's the system that we've gotten, and right now, if you could put yourself in the politics bucket, you're good, and if you end up putting yourself in the race bucket, you're bad. But increasingly, in many places, they're the same thing. The last thing I will say is that regardless of whether you're in the South or not, an effective way to gerrymander is to target communities of color. And the reason why is because if you were to go out to Long Island, not far from where I'm in New York City, mm-hmm. and you were to go to a white neighborhood, it'd be 50-50 Democrat, Republican, and people would live among each other. So it's very hard to sort of draw lines artfully. On the other hand, if you go to communities of color on Long Island, you would easily split them up much more effectively because they're reliable blocks of Democrats. And so whether you're a Democratic gerrymander or a Republican gerrymander, you want to go after communities of color because that will help give your party an advantage.
Emily, tell me if this is a little off topic or off your expertise, but when you look at states, let's use North Carolina again. You look at what happened with gerrymandering there, and then you look at what's happening with some of these voter ID laws, it is hard to see how voters of color haven't been disenfranchised. I just really like your view.
Well, there have certainly been court findings to that effect, and there are kind of two parts to this. So the voter ID laws tend to have a disproportionate effect on voters of color and also elderly and low-income voters because they tend to be less likely to have the forms of ID that the state recognizes. So that's the kind of racial disparity issue in those cases. With redistricting in North Carolina, the Court of Appeals that reviewed this said that black voters had been targeted with surgical precision in the drawing of these lines.
Right.
And this is where the kind of partisan and racial gerrymandering claims intertwine, because in North Carolina, in one of the districts, the people who drew the map said, we were targeting Democrats. They were very upfront about that because that is a legal thing to do, right? Yeah. And so one of the arguments for the Supreme Court addressing partisan gerrymandering is, well, look, if what's really going on here in places like North Carolina is an effort to minimize the influence of Democrats, let's call that what it is. And maybe it's a kind of less poisonous lens than race to look at these kinds of power jockeying situations with redistricting. That, you know, to ask the question, was the legislature trying to disenfranchise Black voters, or were they trying to disenfranchise Democrats, or maybe some mix, right? But
right.
They're related to each other. You're right.
That's interesting. Question here that comes back to technology, Michael, that I wanted to come to from Leon in St. Paul. Hey, Leon, what do you want to know?
There's this notion of the voter efficiency or the efficiency gap, which tries to minimize the number of wasted ballots in a district. And a wasted ballot is either a ballot cast for a losing candidate or it's a surplus vote cast for a winning candidate. And I wonder if what the people think of using technology to maximize voter efficiency.
Michael?
Well, the efficiency gap certainly is a test that was used in the Wisconsin case. It also features in a partisan gerrymandering case in North Carolina, and it can be a really powerful diagnostic tool to tell you when a map goes too far. It's certainly not the only test. There are a number of other tests that are out there, and the good news is they all sort of point in the same direction, and they can help us tell us that we need to take a closer look. What they can't tell you is whether a map is perfect or not. So what they basically do is tell you don't wear a parka to the beach in the summer, but they don't tell you which of the numerous things that you could wear to the beach in the summer you should wear. So they sort of set the outer boundaries. They don't tell you where you should land within that. And there's a lot of room for politics and negotiation and lots of good debate within the permitted boundaries.
So are you saying, Michael, that the technology and the science on this has advanced, what, maybe since the last census? We've got another one coming up in 2020. So much that the way we're doing this, whether it's super partisan or not, is just outdated. Is that right?
Well, it is outdated. Well, so on the one hand, map drawing is about to get a lot more pernicious because evil map drawers will have access to much more data about all of us based on what magazines we read and where we buy our groceries and what we search for on Google and, you know, just all kinds of data. So, you know, they will know a lot more about us and be able to draw districts much more technically and much more with much more pernicious effect. On the other hand, data and computers are helping us police this problem. And things like the efficiency gap and many other models, some people have proposed using computer simulations to generate random maps, and then you can compare those random maps to what the actual map is and determine how likely it is that that's random. So computers and technology are both about to make things a lot worse, but they also could help make things a lot better.
Michael, thanks very much for being with us. Good to have you on the show. Really informative.
Enjoy being here.
And Emily, I was just going to ask you real quickly, I have about a minute, whether you think the landscape that these maps get drawn in, given what Michael just said, after the 2020 census is going to be significantly different than it was last time. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think we are at a point of increasingly sophisticated map making, and that can translate into increasingly extreme gerrymandering. And that's one reason why the plaintiffs in this case are asking the courts to step in. You know, the alternative argument is if things really come to a terrible pass, then the voters will institute nonpartisan commissions or some other way of dealing with this. So right. The democracy has a few different safety valves in it. What worries me about this issue, and I'm really glad you've let us take it on the radio, it's kind of complicated and super wonky and not something that, like, people tend to rally in the streets about, even if it's really important.
Except people like you, right?
Yeah, exactly. Hey, so thanks for having us on.
I really want to tell you that your writing is so helpful in this. So I want you to know that. I'm reading it, and it helped inform the conversation today. So I'm really glad you could be part of this. Thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Emily Bazelon is a staff writer for The Times and a fellow at Yale Law School.